Welcome to the Simply Authentic Podcast, where we hope to inspire you to dream bigger, empower you to take charge of your own life, and challenge you to be your most authentic self. Welcome back to the Simply Authentic Podcast. I'm Angie Mullings.
And I'm Tanya Murfin. And September is Suicide Awareness Month. And what we want to do on the podcast this month is highlight that to bring awareness to it. Probably all of us have been touched by suicide at some point in our lives, unfortunately. And so we have a guest on our show today to talk more about this subject. And it is Dr. Georgina Ashlock, and she's a clinical psychologist. So welcome, Dr. Ashlock.
Thank you. Thank
We're
you
really proud to have you here.
Yeah.
So let's get started. And you just tell us what your background is and maybe why you got into this career field to begin with.
Okay. I have a PhD in clinical psychology. I wish I had a glamorous answer as to why I got into this field, but it's kind of a cliche that I just felt drawn to it, and I think it was drawn to me. So You tend to gravitate to what is comfortable for you and what fits. And so I have a sister who worked for 34 years in surgery as a nurse, and we joke all the time. I say, I couldn't do what you did, and she said, I can't do what you do. So I think you just get drawn to what is natural and comfortable for you.
Absolutely.
So I saw my first patient 36 years ago in graduate school. I've been licensed for 30 years. I've worked in different settings, primarily inpatient settings, but I have worked in community mental health centers, university counseling centers. I did work for 21 years at the federal prison here in town. And now I work at Cox North on an inpatient psychiatric ward, and I've been there for almost 9 years.
Okay.
So inpatient is my preference. That's the setting that I love to work in the most. I enjoy, it's going to sound a little strange, but I enjoy the opportunity to just to kind of bear witness to the pain that people are in when they're kind of in that crisis state and to be maybe that safe person that can help them feel supported and understood. And when people are in a crisis state, I'm sure you can recognize this from different situations in your own life. Crisis is also a time of great change. And so I enjoy having that, it's kind of an honor, kind of a privilege, really, to just meet somebody where they're at in that crisis moment and to kind of help them transform that in their lives into something that's, you know, healthy and productive. So, you know, and outpatient work is great. Community mental health centers, private practice, those settings are great too. Therapy tends to move a little more slowly. People tend to be kind of in a different space than they are whenever they land on an inpatient psychiatric ward. So,
okay. And so our listeners understand, and so that Angie and I can understand.
Absolutely.
Obviously, there's different levels of mental health.
Yes.
And the help that you can get surrounding that.
Yes.
So give us just a snapshot of the difference with maybe seeing a counselor and on up escalating to why you would see a psychiatrist.
Sure. Well, psychiatry versus psychology. Psychiatrists go to medical school and they prescribe medication. Psychologists go to graduate school. And we do therapy and assessment. So it's where we complement each other on a treatment team, but tend to do very different roles on the treatment team. So really the biggest difference between inpatient and outpatient, kind of where the person is on their journey, is that if you are on an inpatient unit, typically that is because things have reached a point that maybe you don't feel safe, or people who love you don't feel safe with you being at home at that time. And, you know, honestly, I really appreciate this conversation so that we can remove a lot of the stigma around that, because we have people come to our unit from all walks of life. We have units that cover the entire age range, the age span. because this can happen to anybody.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So we have folks who are doing pretty well in life, and then maybe they have a series of stressors. Maybe the car breaks down, their marriage is not going well. So maybe they're separating as a couple. Mm-hmm. Their child is having trouble at school, and then they lose their job. Mm-hmm. So anybody can suddenly have a number of stressors that accumulate and overwhelm your ability to cope and to manage. Mm-hmm. So sometimes people are managing very well, but their medication kind of loses its effectiveness. That can happen over time. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they maybe need an increase in medication or a new medication, but the wait to see somebody in the community can be long.
Sure.
There's a pretty high demand. And I know community mental health centers, private practices, they're doing the best that they can to keep up with demand. But if your medication is no longer working and you're starting to have thoughts of suicide, it can be kind of scary to be at home and waiting for weeks to see somebody. So mm-hmm. we are really a soft, safe place for people to land so that we can take care of them and meet their needs as quickly and effectively as possible. So often we hear from patients after they arrive on the unit, they'll say, I had no idea that this, service was here.
Sure.
I had no idea that this was even an option. I didn't know what you offered here. Mm-hmm. And most people say, I'm so glad that I came. I'm no longer afraid of this. Every now and then we'll have someone admit to the hospital and they will say, I had a coworker who was here a year ago, or mm-hmm. I had a family member who was here 2 years ago. And wow. once I heard from them what a good experience it was and how helpful it was, when I started having suicidal thoughts, I didn't hesitate, maybe to come to get help.
Wow. Right.
So, yeah.
Right. If you would please define crisis, because there's different levels of crisis, right?
Sure.
If you could just kind of talk about the different levels of crisis, what might be a crisis to me might not be a crisis to you or anyone else. So.
Sure. Absolutely. It is different for everybody, but I think if you want to define crisis in terms of what level of care that you need, it really does boil down to safety. And so you could have multiple stressors or have difficulty with your medication, but if you're not feeling suicidal or at least at actual risk of acting on suicidal thoughts, maybe you have a good support system at home, maybe you have pets that you love, maybe you have good coworkers, you have friends, you feel supported and cared for pretty well, and you don't feel at risk of hurting yourself, mm-hmm. you can maybe hold on until you are seen by your provider in the community.
Right.
It's when it starts reaching that level where either that person or people who love them start feeling concerned about safety.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's better to not take the chance. It's better to err on the side of caution. Mm-hmm. At least go to the ER at the hospital, mm-hmm. or you can call 911, and that way you can have that kind of support
mm-hmm.
at the house, and at least be assessed by a mental health professional who specializes in determining whether somebody needs the level of care that we can offer. Sometimes people come in for evaluation and they determine that they can go back home mm-hmm. and wait for an appointment or mm-hmm. to see their therapist.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes a professional will weigh in and say, to be on the side of caution, let's just go ahead and admit for a few days. Just again, we frequently have patients who will say, I feel so guilty about being here. I'm not at home right now to take care of my children. I'm not at work to support my coworkers. I was supposed to, provide the food for the volleyball team tonight or whatever. And so people have a tremendous sense of guilt oftentimes that they're in the hospital for mm-hmm. mental health care. And so I usually tell patients two things. One is, if you had been in an accident or needed an emergency surgery, you would also not be at work or not be at home right now, and you probably would have at least less guilt. You might still feel somewhat guilty, but people tend to feel more guilty for mental health, like it's somehow a moral failure or, you know, a sign of weakness if you have to have that level of care. Right, but if your gallbladder suddenly goes bad or your appendix, you may miss work for a few days because you have to go in and get surgery.
Right.
The other thing that I always remind my patients of, or the patients of, is that probably any inconvenience that people who know you and care about you are experiencing right now is minor compared to what they would experience if you were dead.
Mm-hmm.
So it's much better to be here for a few days and to get you back on your feet and make sure you're safe than to lose you.
Mm-hmm.
So I tell patients all the time, we don't want to lose you. And I'm sorry, this conversation might be triggering for some people, and I should have said that at the beginning, because there are some tough things to talk about. So but that's the reality. I mean, nothing is more painful or inconvenient to people who love you than your death.
Yes.
And especially suicide, because people are really traumatized by that, because what we hear often, because a number of our patients have a history of maybe a friend or a family member committing suicide, and oftentimes we'll hear things like, why did they choose, especially like if it's a parent, they'll say, why did my parent choose to kill themselves?
Mm-hmm.
Did they not love me enough? Was I a bad child?
Mm-hmm.
Suicide really has a tremendous ripple effect in the world.
Yeah.
And so even maybe a neighbor that you've never spoken to, but they've seen you walking your dog every evening, and then suddenly you're not there anymore, and they find out that you committed suicide. It's devastating for people, but especially people who love you, because it's really tough to work through that, that somebody would choose to end their life and take themselves out of your life.
Yeah.
So,
you know, that's, that's all very true. I think about when I hear about young people who, or anyone really, who has committed suicide, when you hear that someone had an accident, right, a vehicle accident, you're saddened by that. But it seems to hit us differently, or at least it does me, when I hear that someone, even if I didn't know them, committed suicide, those questions, you're right, immediately come to mind. What was so bad that they thought that this was the only answer? Did they not have people that they could talk to or go to? Did they not know about the suicide prevention hotline? Did they not know? And it's just, it seems to hit us differently when people commit suicide.
Yes, it does. And I will tell you, after talking to people who have been suicidal for the past 36 years, to kind of represent the other side of that, many people will tell you, when I was, you know, in that state of mind, I wasn't really thinking about my friends and family in that way. Like, oftentimes they will say, it was just so dark. It was so painful. It was difficult to think of my children. Or if I did think of my children, I thought my children will probably be better off without me, which of course is not true.
Right.
But in that moment, because of the state that they're in, they can believe that. They can convince themselves of that, which I think is another reason why we need to remove the stigma of inpatient treatment. Because I think there are people who actually make a suicide attempt that if they would have come to us sooner when they first started feeling suicidal. And I think in the beginning, they might think, well, this, maybe I'm overreacting. This is a little silly. But in reality, if they would have come to us sooner, we maybe could have prevented the attempt by getting them the treatment before they reached that point. Again, people do the same thing with medical conditions, with many other things, right? We wait and wait. We think, well, it will resolve, or we can work it out. So, but people will say, once I got to a certain point, I just felt so dark, and my thinking was so dark. It was so painful that they really don't think as clearly as they would have if they had not been in that state of crisis or depression or anxiety. So it really is critical get help earlier in that whole process.
So having said that, what are some signs that we as individuals and our society, with our friends and our family, what are we looking for? Because there is such a stigma behind mental health in general. Mm-hmm. And then you add suicide to that and it's, you know, another stigma there. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of guilt with who's left behind, mm-hmm. of why didn't I see that? Mm-hmm. Why was I not listening closely enough? Was I not watching? I'm certain that those questions just rattle their brain day in, day out. Mm-hmm. So what can we look for? What can we do, mm-hmm. from the outside looking in?
Sure. I think there's two parts to this question that I want to address. The first one is what some of the signs to look for. First of all fairness, I will say there are people that hide what's happening, yeah. to them, mm-hmm. very effectively.
Yes.
So mm-hmm. I agree. Oftentimes people feel guilty and wonder, what did I miss or what could I have done? But the person was maybe going out of their way to conceal.
True.
And so that's tough to see sometimes what's happening. But oftentimes, the biggest thing that I will encourage people to look for is change. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you have a loved one who is typically social and outgoing and involved in things, and suddenly they seem to be more reclusive, maybe they are not attending church or whatever activities, right. the same frequency, mm-hmm. as they did before. Is their hygiene changing a little bit? Are their eating habits changing? Sometimes when people become depressed or anxious or overwhelmed, you might eat a lot more or you might eat a lot less.
Right.
It can,
mm-hmm.
go either direction. Mm-hmm. So if somebody is suddenly losing weight or gaining weight in your life, that might be a sign something has changed with their eating patterns. If they seem to be sleeping more, sleep is also another variable that can go either way.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone seems to be sleeping more or less, if somebody starts telling you, I'm so tired that I can't sleep, I mm-hmm. go to bed every night and I cannot go to sleep. Sometimes that happens when people are in an emotional kind of crisis state,
mm-hmm.
Or they may want to sleep all the time.
Yeah.
So if they are more withdrawn at work, again, just noticing changes in patterns. If people seem to be maybe expressing more guilt or shame about past mistakes. You know, I kind of feel like a failure. I've been thinking more and more about things that I've done wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Or sometimes people will make comments that indicate that they're kind of thinking almost in a manner of settling their affairs.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be pretty blunt. Like sometimes,
true.
People will say, hey, I want to give you grandma's ring,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I know, you know, if something ever happened, I'd want you to have it or something.
Mm-hmm.
You might question, why now?
Mm-hmm.
Why are you,
yeah.
giving me something, you know, that's valuable and important to you? So sometimes it can look like people are kind of putting their affairs in order. Honey, what would you do if something happened to me, you know, if they started talking about, mm-hmm. those kinds of scenarios?
Mm-hmm.
So looking for change, looking for indicators. Sometimes when we are with somebody day in and day out, people can start changing very subtly, very gradually,
sure.
too. So,
mm-hmm.
if you're really busy with life and, you know, you might kind of notice that somebody seems to be having a hard time, but it may not fully register. I get that a lot from people,
mm-hmm.
and who've had that experience with losing a friend or a loved one to suicide. And they'll say, you know, looking back, there were a few warning signs, there,
mm-hmm.
were a few indicators, but I didn't really put the pieces together until,
mm-hmm.
now because, for example, they started a new job, so I thought maybe they weren't sleeping well because they,
mm-hmm.
had the stress of the new job. They,
mm-hmm.
didn't really put it together in that picture of depression and potentially being suicidal.
Yeah.
So it can be tough to you know, it's easier. It's kind of like Monday morning quarterbacking, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can look back and say, well,
of course,
this,
right.
is what should have happened in the ball game. But
of
in
course.
The heat of the moment, people just did the best that they could.
Absolutely.
So.
Do you have any advice for how we broach that subject? If someone is showing some signs, is there a way that we might approach that might not make them avoid us or, you know, that might help them open up?
Yes. Actually, directly is a great way to do,
mm-hmm.
it. It really is okay to just directly ask somebody, are you okay? I'm worried about you. These are the things that I'm seeing. Are you depressed? Are you thinking of suicide? It's okay to just ask directly And, and sometimes that's the best approach. People are more likely sometimes to tell you instead of trying to, you know, sometimes in our own discomfort, we might try to go about that in a more indirect way. Mm-hmm. And then if the person doesn't open up to the indirect questioning, then it may go unquestioned directly. So,
true.
Yeah.
Right. Do you think that some of the stigmas have gotten better? Because I think when I was a younger person that it was much less talked about. It was more embarrassing if you had been to see a counselor or a psychologist. Yes. Certainly, I think that our world is changing fast. Mm-hmm. And I would hope in 2024 that we as a society are way more accepting mm-hmm. of mental health problems and issues. Mm-hmm. Do you, on your side of the fence, see a change in that over the, let's say, the last 10 years even?
I do. What was it? Last year, I think there were some commercials during the football season of professional football players
mm-hmm.
who
yes.
were talking about
right.
having mental illness.
Yeah.
That's
right.
amazing because, again, mm-hmm. yeah. so often people wrongly associate having mental illness with somehow being weak, being lacking in character or strength, when that is not true. It can happen to anybody. Sure. No matter what, you know, your history is or what your life is. So to have these big, burly football players mm-hmm. make these commercials
yeah.
that I have a mental illness and I take medication or yeah. I see a therapist and it helps me,
yeah.
I thought that was amazing. I don't think
agree.
You would have seen that even 10 years ago.
I agree with that.
Absolutely. I think the more conversations we have like mm-hmm. this, the more mm-hmm. we destigmatize mental illness and the different levels of care that you can get for that, the more open this conversation becomes and the more accepting that people are.
Yeah.
You know, you asked the question, kind of what can we do, what can we look for? And I said that it's kind of a two-part answer for me because the other answer that I want to give to that question is, and again, this is going to be a little tricky, maybe a little sensitive, but I think we need to talk about it. I think in our world, sometimes when people are in crisis, we run the other way mm-hmm. instead of running to them,
mm-hmm.
or we judge them, or we are harsh with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way that I practice, so I'm going to digress for a minute into the way that I practice, but help me remember, I want to come back to this
mm-hmm.
spot. So people come to the hospital and they have whatever their presenting difficulty is. And so I look at that with them, but I also then look at their history. And I'm always searching for things that happened, especially in childhood, because childhood is such a vulnerable time in our lives. And there are a lot of things that happened in childhood that are very painful and that we carry with us as
mm-hmm.
adults.
Mm-hmm.
So people are often shocked. We'll start talking about their childhood, and they might say, well, but that's not what I'm here to address. I'm here just to, I'll just give you an example. And this is not one particular patient. This is a conglomeration. These are examples that happen all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody might come in and say, I became increasingly depressed and suicidal. I'm very stressed with my job because my supervisor is harsh with me. And the way they talk to me, the way they treat me. So we talk about that a little bit. And then as I explore with them about their life story, you discover that maybe there was some verbal abuse as a child.
Mm-hmm.
And it ends up, you can trigger that reaction to the verbal abuse as a child
mm-hmm.
by how you're being treated now
mm-hmm.
By a supervisor at work.
Mm-hmm.
So constantly, I'm looking at historical events and factors which relate to difficulties that people are having now. And so patients are often shocked by the connection
mm-hmm.
and very pleased that whenever we work on healing things that happened in the past,
mm-hmm.
that it can directly improve and impact what's happening now.
Mm-hmm.
And there's different ways to do that. There's different levels of therapy. There's a lot of different models of therapy. So, for example, one of the big ones, cognitive behavior therapy, right? So in cognitive behavior therapy, it's amazing. You do a lot of work with how the content of your thinking impacts how you feel and your behavior, and in turn, how your behavior impacts your thinking. And so it's great. And so you could stay at that level. You could talk with someone, for example, about, well, you're viewing your boss as, picking on you. Maybe they're not picking on you. Maybe they just don't have very good communication skills. So you can work on shifting your perspective, which might help you cope better with that situation. But when you go deep and you work on the childhood trauma of the verbal abuse that your dad subjected you to, it heals it in a whole different way. So now when you go back to work, maybe you now feel confident enough to talk to your boss about what's happening, or maybe you decide to put in for a different department or go to a different job. It's a tends to be a different level of treatment, of healing, to go deep. So another common theme that we see is that when people have children, if they have a history of childhood abuse, it tends to trigger that. Because when you have your own child and they start going through the ages that maybe that you went through as a child when abuse happened to you. So we'll see that too. People will come to the hospital and say, I don't know why I'm so depressed and suicidal. I have a new child. You know, I have a baby at home, or my child is three and they're doing great. And then when we start investigating, start digging into that, it ends up, it triggers the childhood trauma. So many things in life, especially when we're kids, but throughout our lives, can cause really deep, deep emotional pain. And so when someone reaches out to someone and says, for example, I'm thinking about getting a divorce. If we pass judgment on that, really, you know, I, because of my beliefs, I really hate to see you get a divorce. And that may be true, but in that moment, is that really what that person needs? What they need is empathy, support, compassion, So another example is that if someone says, I'm not sure about my gender identity. So oftentimes the way that people respond to that is criticism, judgment, anger, when in reality, what that person needs is love and compassion. So it's a difficult journey that we're all on. And so, so if we don't honor each other's pain and where we're at in that journey, it causes great damage. Another example is sometimes people will, in therapy, we will uncover childhood abuse and we'll think, okay, this will be, the abuse itself will be the target that we're going to work on in therapy. And so often what we end up working on is, yes, the abuse itself was traumatic, but what was even more traumatic was how people responded to it. So often somebody might say, well, I tried to tell someone that I was being abused and no one believed me, or they didn't protect me. So that ends up being the real trauma that we end up addressing. Well, I'm confused about my gender identity and I went to my family and I tried to talk to them about it and they said, no child of mine is going to, you know, fill in the blank. And so I was already scared and feeling alone and confused, and now I'm rejected by my family, and that's why I try to kill myself, because I don't have support. I just need someone to love me and accept me unconditionally, So in that crisis moment, that's what people need. So to me, the heart of suicide prevention is that. It's being loving, it's being kind, it's being compassionate, it's being there for people. You don't have to agree with what's happening, with what their decisions are, what their perspective is. It doesn't matter whether you like it or not, whether you agree or not, but you can just acknowledge someone's pain. You can sit with them, you can offer to help them get to the hospital or get even to an outpatient therapist, whatever the level of crisis is. And you don't have to try to convince them that they're wrong or take away from what their experience is. Because so often, if people had the proper support in a time of pain and crisis, they may not escalate to the point of being suicidal.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so we tend to drop the ball with that. Sometimes I would think that that's the biggest thing that we need to do. That's part of the reason why, for most of my 36 years of seeing patients, I tend to gravitate to underserved populations. Mm-hmm. So maybe prison setting or, just populations that folks that don't have good access, easy mm-hmm. access to right. mental mm-hmm. health care. Because if you have money, if you have insurance, if you have the more resources you have, the easier it is to sometimes to get the support that you need mm-hmm. if you're willing to open up and say that you need that support. Mm-hmm. But when you see the response of someone who is just so beaten down and just so alone in the world, they've been hiding, whatever their struggle is, and you come beside them and you let them know. Sometimes I will literally say to my patients, I will literally say, I see you. Mm-hmm. I mm-hmm. see you. Mm-hmm. I hear you and I see you and you're safe. And mm-hmm. so let's talk about this. Mm-hmm. People have to have a safe place to be able to talk about anything.
Right.
Anything. Or we're never going to resolve it. Yeah, right. So,
yeah. I have a question about substance abuse. How often are you seeing where the two come together? Like, how often is mm-hmm. substance abuse attributing to the suicide rate?
Yeah. So the connections between addiction and substance abuse and suicide, there's several. One is that people often gravitate, whether it's drugs and alcohol or maybe gambling, spending excessive mm-hmm. amounts of money, video games. People can get addicted to video games, food. We tend to gravitate to things that comfort us when we're in great emotional distress. Mm-hmm. So you can more easily gravitate to something like that to help ease your pain. So we talk a lot about self-medication. Mm-hmm. So sometimes people worry about the stigma of even taking medication. So mm-hmm. they might turn to, well, every day when I get home from work, I drink, wine, and then that escalated from a couple of glasses to a couple of bottles, and then mm-hmm. I'm drinking, more like on the weekend all day long. I mean, the use can escalate over time mm-hmm. because of the addictive qualities of, mm-hmm. of again, whether it's substances or whatever you're using to comfort yourself. On the flip side of that, sometimes people will say, I was depressed and I wanted to kill myself and I used drugs and alcohol to help me do that. Because if you think about it, the human will to survive is really strong. Mm-hmm. I mean, people will do extreme things to live. Mm-hmm. Like the story a few years ago of the person who was trapped. They were rock climbing and their arm got trapped.
Mm, yeah.
And slowly they, took off their own arm.
Yes.
To be graphic. But because their will to survive was so strong, So sometimes people will say, I wanted to end my life because I'm in so much pain, but to get the nerve to do it, I had to become intoxicated on alcohol or whatever the substance was. I had to use that to give myself the kind of the courage or whatever to try to fight the instinct to live. So,
Missouri has some, I'm going to say, alarming statistics. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, they are statistically higher in Missouri than they are across the nation. Mm-hmm. So there was a article that came out in a news release by KY3, so it's local information, mm-hmm. that our rate here in the Ozarks, they called it, mm-hmm. was 22% per 100,000 people. And the Missouri rate was 18, and the national rate was 13. So there's a big jump between 13% and 22% mm-hmm. in Missouri. Mm-hmm. And there is another statistic on another commercial right now that firearms are involved in 6 out of 10 suicides. Mm-hmm. And that's alarming. Mm-hmm. And then that men are 4 times more likely to die from suicide mm-hmm. than women are. Mm-hmm. So I know those statistics didn't come from you, mm-hmm. but when you hear those things, here in the Ozarks, it really
piques your interest or your attention mm-hmm. to it's a big problem in our area. Mm-hmm. And so do you feel like it is because you're on the front lines of this? Mm-hmm. And in a lockdown facility, you're dealing with most of your patients mm-hmm. have made a suicide threat. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about those statistics and us in general here in the Ozarks? What do your colleagues talk about and is there conversations about those statistics?
We're not necessarily talking specifically about some of that, but if, you know, just thinking through some of the information that you just provided, for example, if you're pretty serious about trying to kill yourself, a firearm is the most effective way to do that, right?
Sure.
So you're going to gravitate to something that you think is going to be the most effective. And also, if you discharge a firearm, you are more likely to die. Mm-hmm. Or if you don't die, that's still more likely to come to the attention of authorities.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
There are probably many quiet suicide attempts by other means that aren't ever reported,
right.
aren't recorded,
mm-hmm.
aren't known.
You're right.
And people tell us all the time, this is my third suicide attempt, but the first two, no one ever knew about it because mm-hmm. I tried to take an overdose of pills and I simply woke up 24 hours later. It didn't
mm-hmm.
kill me.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe they're not telling people. So
mm-hmm.
the difference between men and women, one of the variables there is that men just tend to use more aggressive means. Women
mm-hmm.
are more likely maybe to try an overdose or something, you know,
Got it.
That's a little quieter. Men are much more likely to maybe use a firearm. So
yeah, that makes sense.
You know, this is an area where maybe people have more access to firearms.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So maybe that is part of the equation.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that other parts of the country where maybe people don't have firearms as readily accessible,
it's
that
true.
They aren't quietly trying other ways.
That's true.
And sometimes succeeding. How often are car accidents maybe a suicide? That we
it's
don't
true.
Know because
right.
the person died, because we do get patients who try to kill themselves by car accidents. We have a number of patients who will tell us, I thought about stepping into traffic.
Mm-hmm.
How often do we see pedestrians getting
mm-hmm.
hit
true.
On the
mm-hmm.
news?
Yeah.
So we
it's
don't
a good
know
perspective.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
yeah.
You're right.
If that
yeah.
was a suicide or not.
Yeah.
Are we running out of time?
No, we're good.
Okay.
You're good.
Yeah.
So, I was just going to give a quick analogy, if it's okay. I'll try to make it really short. Kind of the idea of us going to people whenever they're in crisis instead of
mm-hmm.
stepping away. Because
yeah.
mm-hmm. there might be some people listening to this that I might have touched on something that was sensitive. For example, if you have a loved one who's, you know, struggling with their gender identity or whether or not to, you know, get a divorce or something that maybe you feel very strongly about. Many years ago, when I was in my 20s, I was in a terrible car accident, and the car, it's a long story, but ended up upside down on a major interstate, and
mm-hmm.
there was another accident that had happened that we were all coming up on. It was just, this was in a different state, so we didn't know. So imagine being on I-44, and you're topping a hill, and there's
mm-hmm.
there's a big accident in the middle,
yes.
and
mm-hmm.
now you're going 70, 75. So anyway,
right.
Upside down in a car, trapped. And again, this might be a little triggering, but I'm going somewhere with this. So there was a highway patrolman trying to get to the scene of the first accident in order to shut traffic down
mm-hmm.
to try to avoid exactly what happened, which was a chain reaction.
Mm-hmm.
So when your car is upside down, your windows are lower now. So this highway patrolman came kind of sliding up on his stomach on the highway and was looking in the window and seeing if myself and my passenger, if we were okay. And then the fire department came and cut us out of the vehicle. And then I remember being on a stretcher, and they had to shut down this major interstate across the state we were in at the time, both directions. And there were cars everywhere, and people were out of their cars. And
mm-hmm.
it was a big event. And so I'm looking up from the stretcher and seeing all this chaos. And this man runs over to me, and he starts touching me and asking me questions. And he said, I'm Dr. So-and-so, and I got called into the hospital because of the multiple things that are happening on the highway. And he said, I saw them cutting you out of your car.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I thought to myself, I wonder if I need to, you know, come and help this person.
Mm-hmm.
So he pulled off. He was on the shoulder and he ran across the median and was doing a quick medical exam on me on a stretcher as I'm being wheeled to the ambulance. Mm-hmm. And then the ambulance crew had to drive through the median for a while to get me to the hospital. And then the ER was packed. And even though I was injured, it wasn't life-threatening. So I was alone in an examination room and I couldn't have pain medicine, even though I had open injuries. I couldn't have anything until the doctor could come to see me. So they sent this 16-year-old candy striper. You guys probably remember what a candy striper is.
I was one.
So was I. And so, you know, I don't know if they still call them candy stripers, but she was literally in the red and white striped little, you know, jumper, apron or whatever. And she came in and she said, they told me to come in here and comfort you because it's going to be a while before you're seen. And I was so thankful for her because I was scared. I was in physical pain. I was all alone. This accident didn't happen where there were any family in the area. Mm-hmm. I had no one, and my passenger was in another room in even a little more critical condition than I was. And so I look back at that. The highway patrolman came to see me at the hospital to just talk with me about what happened. And he said, I witnessed your accident. He said, I was behind, a couple cars behind, trying to get to the scene. And he said, it scared me to death. And he said, I've never seen an accident that bad happen that way. And he said, when I slid up to your car, I was convinced that I was going to see dead people, or at least severely, you know, more severely injured than we were. And I thought, isn't it amazing that he ran to us? He was dreading what he might see in that car, but he did not hesitate. He ran and slid on his stomach, and glass and blood and whatever fluids from the car were on the road, and the ambulance and the fire department and the physician who didn't even know me and is dangerously running through all of this traffic and people to examine me on the highway, and the little candy striper that stood in the room with me and held my hand and kept me company for a long time before I could even be seen. All of those people ran to me in my time of crisis. No one asked me, well, what is your political beliefs? Well, what is your religious affiliation? Well, where do you stand on this topic? Thankfully, no one judged me. No one questioned. They ran to my aid and they helped me get through that crisis. And I think that's the imagery that I want people to have. When someone is in crisis, it doesn't matter if you agree with them or not, what beliefs they have, what practices they have in that moment. We need to run to them and render aid. We need to just be supportive and loving.
I think that's an amazing analogy
I do too.
End on.
I think so too.
I love that.
Yeah, I do too.
Thank you for that, because I think that brings all of it into perspective. Right?
Yeah.
I want to remind all of our listeners and viewers that if you are in crisis, you can call or text 988 to take action, and that is the suicide hotline.
And please share this episode if you know someone who could benefit from hearing everything that Dr. Ashlock has shared with us today. Please share this episode.
Yeah. Thanks for listening, guys. And we want to thank Dr. Ashlock.
For sure.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you for having
me. And thank you, Gershman, for letting us record here. And we'll see you next time. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. We are going to be talking about some topics that may be triggering. We're going to be talking about suicide, so please listen with discretion.
Thanks for listening to the Simply Authentic Podcast. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram.
Be sure to listen to us on your favorite podcasting app.